welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a software designer, game developer, and renowned blogger who's a familiar face, or at least a familiar, strangely spelt name, to anyone deep in the world of Apple fandom. He's best known for his work at Panic Software, but is increasingly making waves with iOS games like Black Bar and Space Age. Now all he needs to do is find that missing vowel. He is, of course, Mr. Nevin Morgan. Nevin, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Great to be here.
I'm very glad to have you on as well, because what most people probably don't know is that I've been a user of Panic Software for 15 years or thereabouts. So how long have you been with them?
Right now I'm in my, eighth year, I think, seventh wow. or eighth year. Yeah, which, yeah. You know, it's long, but when you think about the total lifetime of Panic, that's like not even half of it. So
still the new boy.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I still think of myself that way. Yeah, I still hear stories about the days of Panic before I worked here, and I sort of go, oh, you know, that sounds like prehistory.
Excellent. All right. Well, enough tech. As we already remarked before we started, there are enough tech shows. This is about pop culture. So, kick us off by telling us what you've chosen and then give us some context around its release, when it was released, its reaction, the reaction to it upon release, and why it is generally maligned and why you think that that is wrong.
All right. We will be looking at the 1997 American science fiction action thriller film Face Off, directed by John Woo, famously starring John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, playing both themselves and each other. The movie was sort of John Woo's first big American production, and at the time, I had to look this up, but at the time, it was actually praised by critics and had really good theatrical, you know, numbers. Since then, I feel like the general reaction by anyone that at least I've talked to, or whenever I look up the movie, is to basically mock it for being completely ridiculous and sort of unworthy of serious consideration as cinema. And it's only, I guess the main reason I chose it is that people think of it as one of those things that's, you know, so bad it's good, if anything. And so you should watch it to laugh at it, basically, which is a thing that I really object to in general with enjoyment of, you know, any type of media. But that, I feel like everyone I've talked to feels that way. And I think that it's one of those movies that's so good it's good. I don't think there needs to be a lot of apologizing for it. So that's my context for why I chose it for this. Incredibly enough, if you look it up on Rotten Tomatoes right now, it's at 91%. So I'm not
wow.
sure. Yeah, I'm not sure that disqualifies it from calling it unjustly maligned. But between you and me, when I suggested it, I feel like it sounded right to you, right? Like, if you ask most people, they would say, like, oh, that's that ridiculous movie where Nicolas Cage and John Travolta swap faces, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm much the same as you. Anecdotally, you know, amongst myself, my friends, people I know, it is generally, yeah, maligned as, oh, that's a terrible movie. Why would you want to watch that?
Yep, absolutely. That's what I hear from everyone. Well, I'm going to tell you why you should watch it, and also what to pay attention to in case your idea of it is that you should watch like big dumb explosions and people overacting. Because even some people who say they sort of like it will often cite those as kind of the reasons to watch it, and I don't think that's the case.
Right. It's interesting that you refer to it as a sci-fi action thriller, which I have seen it referred to as elsewhere. And really, that's kind of a misnomer, because the only
Absolutely.
Science fiction elements are the actual face swapping plastic surgery, which is absurd. I mean, I always feel that any work of fiction, any movie, comic, novel, whatever, you're allowed to sort of ask the audience to make one big leap.
Yep.
You know, you get away with one big thing. And in this case, it's the strange ability to suddenly have plastic surgery to look exactly like somebody else by literally swapping faces with them.
Absolutely. The reason I use that very stilted and awkward description of it is that I was looking at the Wikipedia page just to sort of give the textbook definition of what this is. I wouldn't have described it that way either.
No, it is weird because that is the only science fiction aspect of the whole thing. The rest of it is basically a John Woo movie set in America, isn't it?
Yep. And I've also thought of it in a not it doesn't belong to this genre sort of wholly, but it can be thought of, I think, of as a neo-noir movie almost, at least that aspect of it. Because I find that if you look back to like 1940s and 50s noir movies, there are a lot of premises that are similar to that. What if you could take somebody's identity? Like, changing your identity or stealing identity is huge in noir, right?
Yes.
Not this literally, of course. But that's because this is a movie in the 90s, you know, and technology. I've made this observation before, that in a lot of 1940s and 50s stuff, psychiatry and psychology were sort of the equivalent of what computers are in the movies of the, say, 90s and 2000s, because it's a thing that you sort of know about, that's kind of big in the world, and that lets you do basically anything with the plot, right? Like in the movie Psycho, you know, the movie obviously has a very compelling premise. Now I'm talking about Psycho, not Face Off, just for a second. It's a compelling premise. It didn't need to be explained, but at the end, Hitchcock felt the need to add this very boring scene where they explain the whole psychology of it. It's all baloney. Like, it's not actual clinical psychiatry or anything. But back then, you could get away with it because people were just starting to learn about Freud, you know, and the subconscious mind and stuff. And so, you know, there are probably a lot of people nodding along going, oh, right, yeah, I never thought about it that way. And I feel like that's what the you know, face swapping technology in Face Off does. It's sort of like, if you're watching that movie, and in the movie, when they first suggest this, you know, like, oh, you could literally take this guy's face, you know, and switch it so you could pretend to be him, they kind of explain it as like, well, you know, with the new anti-inflammatory drugs and blah, 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 we can do this in a matter of days. And if you were watching this in 97, you might be going like, yeah, I don't know, maybe that's true. Maybe that's, you know, how it is now with clinical stuff. It's not. We're not there yet, and won't be for a long time. But
for many, many years, I'm sure. Yeah.
Nor do human faces work the way they do, where they sort of just peel them off, like there's actual connective tissue and stuff.
Yeah, and leaving behind eyelids.
Yes,
I don't know if you noticed that, but when Nick Cage's character wakes up, spoilers, everyone, when he wakes up missing his face, and you get a few fleeting glances, it's clear that he still has eyelids, and I wonder if. Did they just not realize? Did nobody mention that? Or do you think they tried it and it was so freaky, they were like, no, we can't do that?
I think it looks more like when they showed a face peeled off, sort of floating in this, you know, bio gel liquid, whatever. I think it looks more like a mask, like a Halloween mask, if you have the eyes cut out and the mouth cut out, right?
Mm, good point.
It has eyelashes. it doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
No.
all that said, I've thought about that. Like, so, you know, as I was trying to get ammo for the the theory that it is a maligned movie, I checked out its Amazon reviews, and you get a lot of complaints about realism, and I'm generally very tired of that argument.
Right.
For so many reasons. The other way that I've thought that you could think about this movie is think of it as Shakespeare. Not all of it, but think of how often in Shakespeare's plays people assume somebody else's identity or change their their gender appearance or you know, do something like that. In Shakespeare, it's done by like putting on a hat and speaking in a mumbly voice, right?
Yeah.
And do people go around, you know, accusing Shakespeare's plays of, you know, lack of realism? It's just it's heightened drama and heightened plotting and high stakes and incredibly interesting situations that you don't find yourselves in on a daily basis. And that's sort of what makes incredibly compelling big stories, you know, rather than, you know, two people fall in love and then one of them, you know, has to go to a place. Like, those are also fine stories, but if you want big, big drama, you have to have these big stakes, which means that you have to have certain things that really bend reality. And in Wu's case, the thing that I think saves it is that it's not like the rest of the movie is completely realistic. It's filled with these completely bananas action sequences. So you just have to accept that this takes place in a world where things like this happen, right?
Absolutely. Well, it's the, like I say, this is literally a John Woo movie made in America. As you said, it was his first big production. He had made films in America before this, but this was the first one where he was given a huge budget and full directorial control.
Control, exactly.
Creative control, yeah. And there are, you can see that he is literally taking stuff that he does almost every movie in his Hong Kong oeuvre, you know, in the heroic bloodshed and gung-fu genres, and just doing them in America. So you've got the doves flying everywhere.
Absolutely.
You've got double gun action. You've got people sliding along the floor while they shoot. All these things, which incidentally now are actually seen as passé.
Yeah.
Because people imitated John Woo and Ringo Lam so much in American cinema that now these things are seen as cliched.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a problem for the movie, for its legacy, right? Again, if you look on Amazon right now, there's so many people saying that the action is cliched. It's like, well, yeah, that's because you're 14, you know?
Right. They invented these cliches.
Exactly. And so there are cliches that are cliches through overuse, and then there are things that sort of are cliches on day one, where you're like, I see what you're doing, but that's just not that cool. If you think for a minute about John Woo's actual action sequences, they are, I mean, now it's a cliche to say this of them, but they are action ballet, they're gun ballet, right? They're really nicely choreographed, and just the sheer motion of people and stuff on the screen is extremely well composed. This isn't like, you know, shaky camera, stuff flying, can't tell what's what. Like, the action sequence is obviously not realistic. Like, you know, if Nicolas Cage is jumping out of a plane sideways, shooting two guns, you know, sideways, and hitting everyone, you know, that he's aiming at, that's not realistic. And it may not make sense, because, like, in the next scene, he's standing. You're like, well, how did he do that if he jumped out of a plane?
Yeah.
But as a self-contained piece of ballet, It's beautiful, you know, just, again, his curves and everything, John Woo's curves and the way things move are always really nice and compelling. And they're also memorable sequences. I rewatched the movie twice for this podcast, and, you know, there's so many things where I'm like, wow, that's a really cool, memorable sequence. You know, John Travolta kicks Nicolas Cage in front of a jet engine, which then blows him, you know, like 100 feet against a, you know, steel fence or something. That it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't mean anything in the movie. It could have been anything, but it's just a cool scene that somebody came up with.
It is, although I must admit that was one of the areas where I was like, don't you just love how in action movies people leave this massive industrial machinery just lying around with no safety protocol,
yep,
just waiting to be activated by hitting one button.
One red button, of course. Yeah. It's also the only reason you would ever have a solitary jet engine that is in a tunnel, like in a wind tunnel, is if you were like doing some sort of testing, presumably, right? Like Boeing is testing a new jet engine, right?
Right, not just lying around in a hangar.
At like a municipal airport, right? Yeah.
In amongst the packing crates.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so many packing crates. That's where all the jet engine parts were, like in empty, large cardboard boxes. That were left whole after stuff had been taken out of them.
If I had one criticism of the action sequences in this movie, because they are very recognizable, as you say, as John Woo action sequences with the action ballet and, yes, lots of locked off cameras and people moving through the frame rather than shaky cam and stuff. Very, what we think of now as almost traditional action, but at the time was actually quite new because it had all been imported from Hong Kong cinema. And everybody was gaga for Hong Kong cinema at the time. But they lose something, I think, in their translation to the American way of filming.
Yes.
I can't really put my finger on it, but they just didn't seem to have quite the same impact or the same beauty as they do in movies like A Better Tomorrow or even Hard Boiled and stuff.
Yep.
They were a bit too long. They didn't move the story forward an awful lot. I did wonder, I know that this script went through a lot of rewrites before it was eventually filmed, and I wonder if, much as John Woo had control in this movie, maybe he should have had a bit more, and maybe he didn't feel confident enough yet to sort of really mold the script more to his style. I don't know. I'm just speculating, but it feels like it's not quite one of his movies.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing is that L.A., or at least the L.A. as shown here, is not as cool as some of the settings in his Hong Kong movies. It's a little bit drab, and it's a little bit 90s, which is American, like, architecture and furniture and stuff in the 90s was unfortunate. It just doesn't have this cool look. Everything looks like what now looks like a cheap mall, because all our cheap malls are from the 90s. So there's a little bit of that. The other thing is that, yeah, you're right, it almost should have been more stylized. My favorite parts of the movie are the very stylized parts. There's a scene where Nicolas Cage and Travolta, who again, you know, assume each other's identities, are sort of chasing each other in this drug kingpin's giant mansion, and they end up sort of in this hall of mirrors. And they,
yes,
there's like a double-sided mirror where, you know, it's a mirror on both sides, and they end up sort of pointing guns at each other through the mirror. Each one is looking at the reflection of himself, which to his mind is the other guy because he's taken his identity. You know what I'm describing. And that's very cool, right? It's sort of a very literal embodiment of the whole message of the movie. It's a cool visual. It's a very stylized space. Why on earth would anyone have a double-sided mirror?
Yeah, it makes no sense whatsoever.
But it makes that scene very cool. And I almost wish, like, you know, like we were talking about the airport. Other than the jet engine being there, it looks kind of like a cruddy county airport. It's not cool enough. So I almost wish that either he had stepped outside of what America looked like at the time and made it a little more colorful, a little more punchy, or found maybe slightly more interesting locations. One of the big locations where Nicolas Cage plants a... I keep saying Nicolas Cage. Let's use his actual name because he has a really cool name in this movie. His name is Castor Troy. And I'll get back to that in a second. Castor Troy plants a bomb at the LA Convention Center, which is so 90s. And so yes. Not cool. It just looks like where the dentist convention is now.
Yeah.
And
probably is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's just, if only they could have maybe scouted slightly cooler locations. Well, while we're on criticisms of the movie, maybe my biggest one is that the grand finale is a boat race. And unfortunately, it's not a super cool boat race. And it also just doesn't match the rest of the movie. There's the scene where they're pointing guns at each other through the mirror occurs about halfway through the movie, maybe a little past halfway.
I think it's a bit more, further than halfway. Yeah, yeah. One of the things that struck me was how slow moving this movie is. Like something like 2 hours and 10 minutes long.
It's
insane.
Long.
Yeah,
it's too long. Yeah, but in any case, the mirror thing occurs before the boat race.
Yes,
and that should have been the grand finale because the boat race has nothing to do with the theme of the movie.
Apart from the fact that you can very, very clearly see the stuntmen
in
many of the shots.
Assuming the identities of Nicolas Cage and John Travolta.
How very meta.
Right. And then the final sort of, their final battle where Travolta, Sean Archer is his character, where he kills Castor Troy with a harpoon. Again, it just doesn't mean anything given the theme of the movie. And the movie does a good job in other places of basically constantly revisiting its theme and stating it different ways. And I wish that the ending had spoken to that instead of just being this kind of like, there's a boat race. Because you could have put that in any movie. That could be in Miami Vice. That could be in anything.
I agree completely. Yeah, that was something else overall about the whole movie was that it did feel... It felt almost like a lost opportunity. Like the performances, I think, are actually pretty good.
Yeah.
Travolta and Cage, I think, do a really good job of aping one another's mannerisms.
Yep.
And also playing a man who's, you know, kind of on the border of insanity because he wakes up with another man's face. These are, you know, that's a fairly complex thing to embody. And I think they actually do a really good job of it. The action set pieces, yes, you know, needed tightening and they do go on over long. But many of them, the main problem with them, as you say, is that many of them just don't feel like they have a point. They don't relate to, as you say, the thrust of the movie. And so it just, the whole thing feels like missed opportunities. It could have been, and I know it was well received upon release. I was surprised to read that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could have been so much better. It could actually be, I mean, I don't think maybe it was ever going to be on the level of something like Die Hard, but it certainly could be remembered a lot more fondly than it is, I think, if they just, ironically, had another draft, another rewrite, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. There are places where the theme is sort of, is at least on my like third viewing, whatever, I was like, oh, I see how that, you know, that relates to the basic theme here. This is going to sound so art school, but I have to get into it for a minute. The movie opens with a scene of Sean Archer, Travolta's character, on a like a carousel with his son. Slow motion scene, desaturated, kind of fuzzy. Clearly, it's a flashback. And Nicolas Cage shoots both of them, killing the boy, wounding Travolta. The original carousel thing, I was sort of thinking about it, and one theme that's sort of there is that Travolta's character is kind of boring in a way that he doesn't have any fun, right? And it's justified in the movie, obviously. You know, his son was murdered and he's now a driven man. You know, his sole purpose is to catch this criminal. But he's clearly kind of a wet blanket, right? Like his coworkers and his family just think that he's no fun. And the whole carousel thing was sort of to me like a stuck, you know, in a loop kind of thing, you know. And he almost needs to be thrown out of it, you know. And that's what keeps happening for the rest of the movie, is that he actually starts having fun with at least some aspects of assuming a criminal's identity and having sort of license to basically lash out in anger and beat someone up, you know, or do something cool, take drugs, whatever.
You're absolutely right. And there is, because knowing how much John Woo loves his symbolism, I agree. That is almost certainly what he intended, why he's on a carousel, what he intended with that. But wouldn't that have been so much better if he had then ended, you know, when it ends and they adopt the, you know, the son of Castor Troy, if he'd taken him on a roller coaster?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yep.
You know, just something as simple as that could have wrapped things up so much better.
Yeah, the whole ending is, it gives you, in terms of story, in terms of plot, what you want, but it doesn't look like what you want.
It doesn't feel like it.
The other thing about that is, well, so there's also a cool scene early on where Travolta comes home and his teenage daughter is, the mom is freaking out because the teenage daughter has decided that she's a punk now. So she has, you know, dyed hair, you know, and, you know, spiky hair.
Nose ring, exactly.
And they're both like, and his objection isn't so much that this is unacceptable, but just like, you know, you're a different person every week. I don't know who you are anymore. Again, reestablishing the theme, right, of sort of revisiting, reinventing your identity and all that. And I thought that was kind of cool. The one part of that that bothered me is, so his son gets murdered early on, and then, this is way too literal, he ends up adopting the other guy's son, right? It's sort of clearly implied that the boy that they, you know, eventually meet throughout the movie is his son. And that's a little bit too literal for me.
It's not a subtle movie, is it?
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing about it that was sort of annoying is that he also has a daughter. Like, is it not a little bit insulting to her that even though he's had this daughter all along, it's like, oh no, I've got a son now. Finally, everything is okay. You know, like,
right.
as if her role is to always be a sidekick to some boy in the family, right?
Yeah. She wasn't enough. Yeah.
Yeah. I wished instead that he had basically established a firmer connection with her and sort of used that as his, I don't know, cure for, you know, his heartache or whatever.
No, but I know what you mean. I wonder if that's just partly a symptom of the times. You know, this is quite an old movie now. It's almost 20 years old, and they weren't quite as enlightened about gender politics, even in the late 90s as we are now. And yes, I do wonder if that was just merely, well, of course he wants a son. He's a man, you know, he's a warrior. He needs a son.
Yeah, exactly. It just never occurred to anyone that instead, you know, he already has a daughter, right? Like the son has to be replaced. There has to be a son. Yeah.
Yeah.
They do give the daughter, Jamie is her name, a little bit of, a little bit of an arc maybe where the, Caster, the bad guy, ends up teaching her basically how to stand up for herself, which she then, of course, uses against him. The only thing that bugged me about that was, you know, early on he shows her how to use a knife, which is kind of a cool scene, right? Her dad, who used to be, you know, this very strict, boring guy, is suddenly teaching her how to use a knife. And then later on, she uses the knife to stab Caster when she realizes who he is. That could have also been the ending of the movie, right? Like, why does Sean have to be the one to get him?
Oh, that's just Hollywood heroic logic.
Right,
That's, you cannot let a secondary character take out the main bad guy. That's Hollywood 101. You can't do that.
Right, but she is, and I wonder if maybe Wu, coming, you know, from a different culture, would maybe see it this way. She's of his blood, right? She's the continuation of this race. Like, because the whole movie, the early on, when he thinks he is caught Caster Troy, he says, like, okay, you know, I'll finally get a desk job, I'll go to therapy, you know, I'll take it easy, you know, he's making all these promises to his wife. Why not let him do exactly that and basically pass on the torch, and, you know, and so let the next generation basically take care of it? Imagine also the potential for a sequel there, where his daughter ends up switching faces with someone else.
With Gina Gershon or something. Yeah.
Sure. Why not? Yeah, none of that will happen, but it would have been kind of cool to see that.
I think that would have been very cool, but I think we are coming at this from too modern a sensibility. I think I agree, that's actually quite a good premise for a movie, and I'd really like to see that. But you would never have got that movie made in the 90s. Even the strange exotic man from Hong Kong would never have got that made in Hollywood in the 90s.
Well, probably getting the premise okayed at all was probably an uphill battle, right?
Oh, well, maybe so. But like I say, apparently, and I only know this from reading up on it before the show, but apparently this is a script that was originally written back in 1990 and then went through years and years of development hell and rewrites and what have you before finally it was, well, either given to John Woo, or John Woo read it and decided that he wanted to make it.
So, I mean,
the premise wasn't his necessarily. I think the difficulty he would have had getting, you know, anything past production people was changes to the script, which is why, as I mentioned earlier, I wonder if maybe he wasn't able to mold the script quite to his own sensibilities well enough.
Right. Or he may have just been picking his battles. I mean, I often think about this with movies or whatever, like, it's rare that a director gets exactly the movie they want, and they're probably aware of that. And of course, they're not going to talk about it publicly, at least not for a long while. But, you know, he's an extremely smart guy. I'm sure at some point he realized, like, okay, well, this isn't ideal, but heck, you know, I'll pick my battles.
It's better than Hard Target.
Right.
Or even Broken Arrow.
Broken Arrow, yeah, exactly.
Now there is a terrible movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since the 90s, but I don't remember having much fun with it then.
The problem with 90s movies, and I talked about this a little in an earlier episode when we were discussing Last Action Hero, the problem with 90s action movies is that a lot of them suffer from being so close to the release of The Matrix.
Oh, yeah.
And this one, I think, suffers for that as well, because it's clearly late 90s, and it was... I mean, I did wonder if the reaction to it would not have been anywhere near as good at the time, never mind the legacy, but at the time, if it had come out post-Matrix.
Oh, yeah.
Because The Matrix really did change everything in terms of American action cinema.
Right.
And so it's probably good timing that this came out a year or 18 months before The Matrix.
Speaking of it as a 90s movie, there's something in it that I thought was very interesting, and this is probably because Wu is coming from Hong Kong. For a 90s movie that is set in the 90s in LA, it is extremely short on pop culture, like references and mentions.
That's true.
And because 90s movies were so full of that, like that's, you know, Pulp Fiction sort of exploded that entire, you know, crate of goods, and everybody suddenly thought that they had to constantly talk about the fast food restaurants and 1980s, you know, musicians and whatever in their movies all the time. This is way more timeless, and that's another thing where it felt a little bit neo-noir to me, is that, you could make this same movie today and you would have to make very few adjustments to any key plot points or anything. I was watching out for that specifically when I rewatched it the last time. There are no mentions basically of anything that's tied to the 90s.
Right.
All they say about the, you know, surgery thing is, you know, well, nowadays we can do X. Of course, they couldn't then, they can't now. 50 years from now, they won't be able to, so you can say that anytime.
Right. So it's an evergreen concept, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and in that sense, it also felt a little bit like classic heightened drama to me, you know. The concept of borrowing somebody else's identity is as old as folktales, right? You know,
a man,
you know, goes off to war. 2 years later, somebody comes back and claims that they're him, but the wife doesn't believe it, you know, that kind of thing. It's fairy tale-ish, right? And there is something of that timelessness to it, which was a little bit refreshing.
You've just reminded me, actually, that there is one other science fictional aspect, and that is the prison.
Oh, yes.
Erewhon prison, which is one nice little reference that made me chuckle.
Yeah.
But that is quite science fictional because they all wear these weird Wi-Fi controlled magnetic boots that the guards can shut off and immobilize them at any time.
Yep.
That was just weird.
Yes.
What did the guards say? He said, this whole prison is one giant magnetic field. And I'm thinking, not while you're carrying guns, it's not.
I wish that the movie almost had more moments like that, because that's a nice moment, that nice thing of nice piece of design, right? Somebody thought, hey, what if you had a prison that's like this? And I think that's one thing about the action sequences, some of them, that makes them a little fuddy-duddy is that they lack that kind of cool trick. That one is interesting. Yeah, you know, prison where you have magnetic boots, and so they can see you on a radar type screen, and they can lock them down as needed.
Well, and that was a real piece of proper production design as well. Like, yeah, the sets, everything's clearly designed and made to look like this strange dystopian prison. Do you know? I've just realized what it reminded me of, the 1984 Apple ad.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, that kind of 1984 like dystopia of everybody in, you know, the same uniforms marching through the corridors, everything's gray and barren. Really reminded me of that.
It's a bit Metropolis also, like with them all marching in formation, right? And here they literally can't step out of formation, right? Like the boots are, you know, doing what they're doing. I almost wish there had been a little more of that kind of thing. That the prison gets used, you know, early on, but then they sort of just drop the whole thing, which I guess is fine.
Never mentioned again. Once he breaks out of it, that's it. Move on.
They don't need it in the story. But yeah, later on, it sort of switches to settings that are a little too TV movie, like a funeral, right? The docks, things like that. It's just
the standard villain's warehouse,
right? Exactly. Yeah, they're just not. Not designed enough.
Somebody cracked a joke on Twitter the other day about how every city in American TV drama has an empty warehouse district.
Yep.
And this really reminded me of that. Like, oh, of course the villains all hang out in an empty warehouse filled with TVs and couches, and there's a makeshift bedroom for the boss upstairs. Oh, goodness.
Yeah. These are also handy for breaking into if you're being chased or, you know, if you're being pursued. Always incredibly easy to break into with no safety features of any sort. Yeah. The lights are on, though, so you don't have to do that. Yeah. They leave them on.
One other thing, sort of talking about lost opportunities that I've just seen looking through my notes, you know, they make a real point about the voice chip that they're using. Mission Impossible style voice chip where, oh, we'll program this so that you sound like him. And they make a really big deal of that. And the guy's like, it'll be fine as long as you don't do any damage to it or dislodge it. Or
Don't get hit in the throat.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you're thinking, oh, okay, well, that's clearly going to be a plot point.
Yeah.
And at one point, I can't remember who, one of them attempts to strangle the other. Literally, you know, like clamped on his throat, strangling him. And I was thinking, oh, okay, this is going to screw up his voice chip.
Yeah.
And then it won't work. And then people will see through the discuss.
Nope.
Just completely ignored.
Yep. There must have been a scene shot basically that didn't work out for whatever reason. And they left the original setup, right?
Have to think that's got to have been in a draft somewhere.
Right. It would have been a great moment, right? Like, the telltale voice chip. I mean, yeah, It would have added a moment of tension. The movie doesn't have enough of those, right?
Yes, I made that exact note myself.
Tension in the sense of, like, you as the audience member know something up on the screen, like, one person knows something, others don't, and there's that, like, you know, will it happen, will it not, that kind of thing. Yeah, it's lacking that.
Yeah, I made that exact note, that there is a distinct lack of tension in the whole movie.
Yep.
I mean, action scenes are a release of tension. You don't build tension during action scenes, but there's no build-up of tension into the action scene. It's just like, okay, some people say a few things, now we have an action scene.
Yep, yep.
There's no sort of rise and fall. The whole movie felt quite flat as a result, I think.
Yeah.
Which, again, you don't really expect from a John Woo movie. You do expect that rise and fall of, you know, action and calm and tension rising and all that. And it just felt like that was missing from this.
I've felt this way about most John Woo movies, that towards the end, when they get into the, you know, the chase and the shootout and everything, yeah, a lot of that gets dropped. Like, he often has cool action stuff, but not enough changes, I guess, in the stakes or in your understanding of the situation for you know, real tension to happen. Mm. There are some moments, I think, early on when both us and the characters are first coming to terms with this new reality where they've, you know, switched identities. I mean, first we get Travolta, the cop, takes Cage, the criminal's identity. Okay, fine. Like, the risk there isn't as high. But then once Cage wakes up from his coma, takes Travolta's identity, the first scene where they show that, where Cage / Travolta, the cop in the criminal's body, is in the prison, and he's sort of, you know, waiting around to be released as he expects to, and then the, you know, criminal in the cop's face shows up. I thought that was a good moment of, like, oh no, like, now you sort of have to think about all the implications of this. Like, what would you do, right, in that situation?
Mm.
And I thought that was a good moment. But yeah, not enough of those later on. They don't play enough with the whole thing of, you know, of having to prove who you are and whatnot. He has to do it one time to his wife, and that's about it.
Which she solves with a blood test. Yeah, that's it. That's all it takes.
yeah, exactly. There's a few tiny moments. There's a sort of a super creeptastic, in a good way, in the sense that they intended it to be creepy, moment where Cage in Travolta's body sort of enters his teenage daughter's room.
Yes.
Remember this scene? Yeah. And he's sort of very suggestively leaning past her to grab her pack of cigarettes or something. And That felt kind of dangerous. I wish they had done, you know, kind of a few more things like that. One thing we have to discuss. This is a fun movie, right? And this is a movie where the good guys win and everything's good at the end of the day, right?
Yep.
There is one enormous aspect of the plot that does not fit that mold, which is that when Cage pretends to be Travolta, he very much enters carnal relations with his wife, right, at home.
Yes.
That totally happens. That is made 100% clear. I mean, they don't show it or anything.
He even boasts about it.
And she confirms it, so it's not an empty boast.
Oh, yes, that's true, yeah.
I feel like in most movies of this type, they would have come up with some way to skip that, right? Did it feel to you like it sort of crossed the line?
Well,
not that it crossed the line that it bugged me, but just that I was surprised that they went there.
Right. I don't think it crossed a line so much as I was surprised there weren't more consequences.
Oh, right.
But again, this talks about sort of the slight flatness of the movie. You know, it's, again, as you said, it's the sort of thing that you would expect to see possibly in a noir treatment of this sort of concept, but they don't deal with it really, other than she's like, oh, how terrible.
And Nick
Cage's character is like, ha ha ha, I had your wife. And that's pretty much it. You know, they don't really dive into it at all. And okay, I know it's an action movie, you're not going to dive too deeply. But really, this is also 2 hours and 10 minutes long. You could have taken a couple of short scenes to show some ramifications there, which would have helped then dial up the tension, give us more sympathy for the characters.
Many other directors would have also added a scene where the wife gets her revenge also now.
That's true, yes.
I don't believe there's a scene where, like, she just needs to kick him in the crotch or something, right? That's enough to sort of establish, you know, her basically revenge. But I think she gets zero. She, like, doesn't even interact with him.
No, you're right. She gets absolutely nothing. The only interaction she has, in fact, I think the final interaction she has is after she does the blood test and he comes to find her at the hospital because he's suspicious.
Yes.
And she's treating a patient and she basically says, he says, like, why did you leave in the middle of the night? And she's like, I'm a doctor on call. That's what happens. Now get out. And that's her final interaction with him. And that, you're right, that's not satisfying at all, is it?
Yeah. I mean, at that point in the plot, maybe she can't really do much. But once the cat's out of the bag, once they're chasing him, why not add a little bit where she just happens to be there after the, you know, the boat race to, you know, push the harpoon in farther or something like that?
Mind you, then again, she wasn't even at the hospital. They have to engineer the, because of the way they do the ending.
Yeah.
She's not even at the hospital when he gets his real face back.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
wow, this is a cold relationship.
Right. Exactly.
Oh dear. Okay, so we've done it down quite a bit. So I want to hear now, what is it? Because you said at the start that you genuinely like this movie. You don't think it's so bad it's good. You do genuinely think it's good. So I want to hear, what is it about it that really appeals to you and actually makes you look forward to watching it again?
All right. I'm going to start with a quote from Hitchcock.
Okay.
And it's that most movies, he said, most movies are pictures of people talking. And this was sort of his mocking of talkies that don't tell a visual story. And many parts of Face Off are very much visual storytelling. The entire opening is a completely dialogue-free, sound-free, basically, scene that establishes the main two characters and sort of the impetus for why they're facing off, if you will. So I like that there's a lot of visual storytelling. In the action scenes and the chases, some of my favorite parts are actually not the actual action, but the little moments of pause that sort of paint the character. Early on in a chase where Cage is up in an airplane that's trying to take off and Travolta is chasing after him in a car, Cage sort of very heartlessly shoots a hostage and throws her out of the plane. That in itself is, you know, whatever. But after that, he sort of does this little, you know, shot in slow motion shrug of like, you know, oops. And I feel like little things like that are very good at immediately establishing his character, his attitude, right? And like what he will and won't do. And so it just paints him as insane very quickly. And I like all of those little moments. The other thing that I like is I wish more movies were actually more stylized. I feel like we're at a point now, I don't know how long we've been there, but where people only allow for a lack of realism in sci-fi movies, like straight up sci-fi movies, like the Avengers, you know, kind of stuff where just anything goes. If you have a movie that's set not in a world of superheroes or supernatural stuff, people then immediately want it to be 100% realistic. Like nothing can happen that stretches even plausibility, let alone like the laws of physics. And that bugs me because I think human stories, which is what this is. I mean, it is about relationship between people and their guns. Those stories also need the freedom to basically do extremely implausible things. And I like that this movie does that. I'm not sure I can think of a lot of recent movies that do that well.
Well, actually, I agree with you, but I think and hope that we are actually moving out of that. And regular listeners to this podcast are going to be absolutely sick of me mentioning these movies.
Go.
But the Fast and Furious movies.
Sure.
Enormously popular.
Yes, enormously
successful, especially the last couple, you know, the most recent ones. And they do exactly what you're saying. They are set in a non-fantastical, non-supernatural, non-sci-fi world. And yet every action scene in the movie defies the laws of physics six ways till Sunday. And they're incredibly popular. And the fact that they do defy the laws of physics is part of the attraction. That's what people go for the insane, outrageous stunt sequences. So I think that's a good case where a good way to suggest that perhaps we are moving out of that and into a more acceptance of stylized stuff outside of science fiction. But I agree that they're still an anomaly at the moment. I just hope that their success means they won't be such an anomaly in the future.
It might be also that I'm looking at it through my little, you know, window into the world of, you know, people I hang out with. Most people I hang out with who have not seen any of the Fast and Furious movies, especially the recent ones, think that they're, again, sort of dumb entertainment. And they're
right.
I don't think they're dumb in any way.
No, not at all.
I've liked a whole bunch of them. I really liked the last one. They're movies where every single thing is firing just as it should be. Like, they knew what movie they wanted to make, and they made that movie exactly. And it's not a despicable movie in any sense. So it's not like they succeeded at something bad. They fully succeeded at making what they wanted. Yes, I absolutely agree. It bugs me, I guess, that maybe 15 years from now, again, when you talk to people who maybe weren't watching them now, they might think, oh yeah, those were those silly car chase movies from the 2000s, you know?
Possibly,
and
yeah.
I hope their legacy can be a little bit more than that. And I hope people can, yeah, take them a little more seriously, maybe.
You mentioned Castor Troy's name.
Uh-huh,
you said that you wanted to come back to that, so I'm just reminding you of it.
Yeah, just the fact that the bad guys are called Castor Troy and his brother Pollux Troy, and then the good guys are called Sean, Jamie, and Eve. Castor Troy and Pollux Troy just sort of sound cool to me. They're sort of wildly unlikely names, but again, this is set in a world where that works. And I guess I want... more movies that are stylized to that point where people have names like Castor Troy or Vincent Vega or whatever, you know. I want more cool character names. Speaking of Fast and Furious, I think the characters there have pretty dull names.
They're fairly regular names, yeah. Or, you know, sort of slang names, you know, Dom, Han, Roman. Yeah. You know, they're identifiable, but they're not names that say anything about their characters.
It's not like Darth Vader, where without having seen the movie, you're like, oh my God, that is a super bad guy, right? The art of naming characters well, I want that to come back.
It's funny you should mention that at the time we're recording this. We're recording this not long after the opening of Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
And that movie is filled with
what
you might like to think of as, you know, nominative determination. People whose names really reflect their characters.
So good.
And that's also, to bring this back to something you said earlier, that is also a really good example of that rare thing, and I wrote about this actually in a post on Tumblr, of a director getting to make exactly the movie that he wants to make with no compromise. And, you know, it's just pure vision out of George Miller's mind. And you speak to anybody or read any interviews with anybody who was on that set, and they will all tell you, we just did what George told us. You know, none of us, we couldn't contain this thing in our heads. We just went where he told us and did what he told us. And now look at this beautiful result. So again, you know, that may have, because that's been so enormously successful, maybe that will have an influence on movies going forward, and maybe we'll start to see a resurgence of people with crazy names like Immortan Joe and Imperator Furiosa.
I love those names, but I love the smaller names too. There's a guy called People Eater. We don't see him eating people or anything like that, but obviously he's a bad guy. Just giving him that name also lets you know, oh, he's probably also a cannibal, right?
Yeah.
Bullet farmer. We don't see anything about him being the guy who produces the ammo or the guns or whatever, but now immediately you know, like, oh, in this world, he's probably the guy in charge of that.
And you're right, Castor Troy just sounds like, well, it sounds like either a villain or some impossibly square-jawed hero. It could be either.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Castor, at least, is a name I've heard, right? Pollux is... I don't know what that is.
Yeah, that's absurd. I've never... The only context I have of that is Jackson Pollock, the artist. Yeah.
But except Pollux Troy spelled P-O-L-L-U-X.
Oh, is it? Yeah, oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Wow.
They show it at one point, like when they're scrolling files on a computer or something.
Okay.
Oh, do we need to talk about 1990s computer interfaces in this?
They are terrible, aren't they?
Oh, God. They're both terrible, and also, I had, when I rewatched... Well,
they're glorious in a retro fashion, yes. Yeah.
But what I wondered was, 20 years from now, you know, when kids see this, will they think that this is how computers were in the 90s? Or, like, will they know enough to know that that wasn't the case?
Well, think back, you know, in the 90s, if we watched a movie from the 70s with computers, so, say, Alien.
Yeah.
Did we think that that was a good reflection of computers? I don't think we did.
Alien is set in the future, though, so it has a little bit of that. I'm trying to think. If I saw War Games, for instance.
Mm. Oh, okay, yeah.
I guess I didn't know, at least as a kid, which parts of that were real and which were not.
But in the 90s, looking back, did you think that it was realistic? I think that's the question. Yeah, if we're going to talk about Face Off, looking back at Face Off now.
Right.
So... that's a tough one to answer, really, isn't it?
Yeah. They show two kinds of computer interfaces in Face Off. There's like the FBI, you know, like dossier browser, whatever, and it looks totally bananas. It has the awesome thing where he hits a button and a big red box shows up that says "case closed." I think that's how the FBI works, right? You just hit he's not the FBI, whatever he is, but like you hit one button and you close the case, right?
Seems legit.
That's the the actual legal way to proceed with that. and then they show the sort of the bomb program that Pollux wrote, right?
Oh yeah.
Which is sort of like first looks like a sexy lady, and then she turns into a skeleton because it's actually a bomb, and then there's sort of like quick time animations or whatever it was at the time flying over the screen. Yeah,
terrible animated sprites and stuff.
Yeah. Just,
and also the very idea that you would set a countdown for, what was it, like 16 days or something?
Yes. What was the point of that? I totally didn't understand it.
Utterly bizarre, yeah. And not only that, but you have a massive readout, digital readout, you know, so countdown timer that doesn't do it in, like, days. It's got about 15 figures. It seems to go down to microseconds. I'm like, if you're setting this for days, you probably don't care about the seconds.
Yeah, the thing is, they mentioned at one point, so the bomb is going to blow up half of LA, and they're not doing it to blow up LA. They're doing it because they were hired by, I think they say, Malaysian terrorists.
Who you never see again.
Right, exactly. But hired by Malaysian terrorists, okay, if they're... yeah, I was trying to think of that. If they're Malaysian terrorists, they have one of two goals. One, terrorism, blow up LA. In that case, set it for 60 minutes, however long it takes you to get... well, 3 days, however long it takes you to get out of LA. That's a joke about congestion in LA. And then the other goal could be, they're going to ask for release of prisoners or whatever, right? In which case, why has nobody heard those demands?
Right. So, well, or in which case you don't have a countdown, right? What you have is remote detonation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which you would do in any case, right? Countdowns in general are bananas. Did bombs ever have that? I mean, I know that, like, dynamite has a fuse. Are people just trying to translate the dynamite fuse into a digital thing?
Honestly, I have no knowledge of actual, you know, genuine terrorist explosives like that, so I really don't know.
Sure. Say that on the podcast. You think that's going to cover
you? Just in case the feds are listening. Yeah.
Which we hope they are. We hope everyone's listening to the podcast.
Big red button, case closed. I'm reminded of that 1990s Sandra Bullock movie, The Net.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not a good movie at all. And part of the reason that it's not good is that the most tense moment in the entire movie is when a piece of software is copying from a hard drive onto a floppy disk.
Yep.
And you're literally watching a 2-bit graphic of a progress bar go up the screen on your gigantic 50-foot cinema screen.
Yep.
You know, what's filling it is a black and white progress bar from the, I don't know, OS 6 or something. Well, System 6, as it would have been called then.
Computers are deflating a lot of drama. It's just really hard to make chats and stuff seem compelling on the big screen, you know? It's.
I agree. I think for some of the legitimate complaints people have about it, I think Sherlock, the new Sherlock, you know, with Benedict
Cumberbatch
from the BBC, one of the good uses of that, where they have the superimposed text messages and Twitter messages on the screen and stuff.
Yep.
That's a really good way of doing it.
Yep, yeah, that's where it's, and again, because, you know, sort of going back to what we kind of started with, it's stylized, right? This isn't what it actually looks like in the real world. it is an impression of what it feels like when a bunch of people are getting a text message or reading tweets or whatever.
It's treating your audience with a bit of respect and assuming that they are smart and intelligent and can follow along with that stuff.
It's also visually more interesting than a camera pointed at a phone or a laptop, right?
Oh, yes.
That will never look cool, I feel.
No. Not until we have 3D holographic interfaces at any rate.
yeah, exactly. So yeah, doing something stylized like that will always be better. I guess we just have to find ways to do that for more things. That's the equivalent of a 1940s movie where somebody gets a letter and then instead of, like, the old thing used to be to just pan on the letter, right? But then movies started getting into hearing the voice of the actor, right?
Yes.
Reading, right? So it's that kind of impression, right? Because that's what it feels like inside your head. You hear it in their voice and all of that.
You have sound and vision. Use them both. I think, if anything, the great tragedy of Face Off is that doesn't give the audience enough credit, doesn't assume they have enough smarts. And again, I wonder how much of that is Wu possibly deliberately changing some of his style, thinking, oh, Americans will prefer it this way, or whatever, you know, who knows? It's all speculation. But I think that's the great tragedy. If they had approached it and thought, actually, we can make a fairly smart, knowing, you know, it's a movie with a wink, but nevertheless, a fairly smart action movie here, then I think it could have been so much better. But instead, to me, it just falls flat.
I'm overall happy with the movie. I will say that. So we might have to disagree on that. I think what it lacks compared to some of his other movies is, for instance, throwaway scenes. Even though it's over 2 hours long, it doesn't feel like it has scenes that are there just to paint characters or to paint the world or something like that.
That's true.
And I feel like that would have been good. It's a little bit claustrophobic. But that's just because there's so much at stake and it gets going so early that there's like no time for it to just take a breather, right?
There's no scene of Chow Yun-fat playing the saxophone.
Exactly. That's exactly the scene I had in mind, right? Like, that scene doesn't matter, but yeah, you know why it's there. It's painting something. It's also a contrast to the other stuff that happens. There should have been a little more of that. I guess they have to, I was trying to think, if they made him a lower-ranked cop, would that actually not make it more likely that he would be the one put through the plastic surgery?
Because, well, yes.
Right? Yeah. Who on earth would send, like, the highest-ranking person through that? I mean, the explanation in the movie is like...
But it's personal.
Right. Well, but it could be personal if he was lower-ranked. But the explanation in the movie is like, oh, you're the person who knows him best, so you can impersonate him, right? You know everything about him. You can pretend to be him. But that could be the case even with a... Right, think how much more interesting it would be if you were a lower-ranked cop.
You could brief somebody. You know, this is the sort of stuff that you could tell someone.
Yeah.
Let's bring things to a close there, I think.
All right.
Never Morgan, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Probably the number one place would be on Twitter. My account is my last name, MRGAN. It's dumb jokes, if you like this. Also, Mergan.com, MRGAN.com. Anything I do will be on one of those eventually.
Nevin, thanks very much for coming on the show. You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned with Anthony Johnston and Nevin Morgan. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Tries to do something big, and that doesn't always succeed, but it succeeds often enough for me.
Right, but it's admirable to have at least tried.
Yeah, absolutely. And tried something that looks ludicrous on paper, you know. Not try to like
looks pretty ludicrous on screen as well. did I miss something, or did it take almost 2 hours before John Woo brought out the doves?
Oh yeah, it's only in the church, right?
Right, they're not anywhere before then, are they? That's crazy. Normally, you know, you'd expect to see them within 5 minutes of the opening credits. And a municipal airport with an incredibly long runway.
Yes.
Talking about Fast and Furious, that really reminded me of Furious 6. No, Fast 6, whatever they called it.
Which one?
Furious 6, whatever. The one that ends with them chasing a plane down a runway.
Yeah.
And somebody worked out, it was posted somewhere online, it was brilliant, somebody worked out how long the runway would have to be according to the speeds that everybody's supposed to be going and how long that scene takes. Because that's the climax fight of the movie. That's like 20 minutes long. And they figured out that this runway would need to be something like 27 miles long.
Yeah.
Is that cable I hear in the background?
That was cable.
Don't worry, I'll edit that out.
Hi, Erica.
Hi, Steven.
What are we doing here?
Well, we are talking about a Doctor Who podcast that we do together called Lazy Doctor Who.
Oh, really? What's that about?
It's where you and I watch Doctor Who from the very first episode, made in 1963, up to the present day, and then we talk about it on the podcast.
What, over 800 episodes of Doctor Who, from William Hartnell to Peter Capaldi, all in one sitting?
No, silly. We talk about each episode as we watch them. Or maybe we talk about a couple episodes per podcast, or however many we feel like watching in a particular night.
How on earth are we going to fit all of these podcasts in?
Well, that is the beauty of it. We record a podcast whenever we get around to it, and for however long we want to talk for. We're lazy like that.
So, it's a Doctor Who podcast where the hosts are kind of lazy, so...
Yep, Lazy Doctor Who. Find it on the Incomparable Network, on iTunes, or at lazydoctorwho.com.
Thanks for explaining that. I was feeling...
Lazy?
Yeah.